Well, hello, friends. Thank you for joining us here on Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Liz, and I'm happy to be here in the studio for our science article of the month, Shaking Things Up. And with me in the studio are my two friends. First of all, to my left, I have Amanda. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Liz, and hi, listeners. Good to be here.
Okay. And with Amanda, we also have Brian. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Liz, and hello, listeners.
All right. So, Amanda, Brian, what are we here for? What are we talking about?
Well, the title of our article says to shake things up, shaking things up. So are we going to shake things up today, Liz?
Well, that depends on what kind of shaking we're doing here. Normally, when we say shake, we're talking about something that gets moved around in a very fast way, back and forth or up and down, like a salt shaker, all right? But the word shake has also been used to describe dancing, for example, modern dances. Mm. And sometimes we would say somebody is shaking things up on the dance floor, you know, shake it. But we're also talking about other kinds of things here, like in today's article, being a science article, we're talking about earthquakes. So when we have an earthquake, what do we feel?
A lot of shaking.
Exactly. So shaking things up can mean so many different things. And the writer, I think, is also having a little fun with this expression. But also with the phrase shaking things up, we're talking about maybe a topic or an issue that is getting more attention and people are starting to get maybe either more excited or more serious or more focused on something. So it's getting more attention as a result. And so this issue about trying to predict earthquakes, getting more attention, people are more concerned about it. You know, we're shaking things up about this. All right. What's below the title, Brian? Shaking things up. And then what do we see?
We see the deck here, which reads, after the devastating 2011 earthquake, early prediction is a huge priority for Japan.
All right. How many of you still remember that rather tragic moment? Mm. Yes.
Definitely.
Yes.
So we're going to find out what Japan is doing. And it was a very unfortunate incident. It was just terrible. And so people are trying to figure out ways to make sure that history doesn't repeat itself. I mean, there's no way we could avoid earthquakes, especially those of us living in the Pacific Rim, mm-hmm. where we have earthquakes going on all the time. But the question is there a way to be smart? Can we find ways to minimize the damage or the casualties and just not have so many people get hurt? And that's what we're going to find out. So, friends, if you have a copy of your Advance magazine, February Advance magazine with you, please open up to page 40. And our article is a three-day article. Today, day one, we're going to look at page 40, and we're going to have today's lesson divided into two sections. So for the first part, please follow along.
Shaking things up. After the devastating 2011 earthquake, early prediction is a huge priority for Japan. Japan keeps watch for the next big earthquake. If you expect your sensors to transmit data from the seafloor for a decade or more, it pays to do a lot of testing up front. That's why Eiichiro Araki and fellow researchers from the Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology set up shop in 2014 in an equipment plant on the outskirts of Tokyo. We need to make sure everything is working, Araki said. Once the instruments are cemented into a half-mile deep borehole under 6,500 feet of water, it'll be too late to fix glitches. Araki's goal is to spy on the infamous Nankai Trough, an underwater fault similar to the one off the coast of the U.S. Pacific Northwest. Both are capable of releasing earthquakes and tsunamis on a par with the disaster that struck Japan's Tohoku coast in 2011. And both faults are so far from shore that land-based instruments provide only a fuzzy view.
All right. So the writer begins with an interesting statement. If you expect your sensors to transmit data from the seafloor for a decade or more, it pays to do a lot of testing up front. Actually, it's quite a loaded sentence there, I think, both from a language standpoint and also from information standpoint. If you expect your sensors, so generally speaking, the writer is not talking to a particular person in mind. It's just generally speaking, if you have sensors that you are going to use for a decade or more, basically you're hoping it'll last for 10 years or more, and it's going to be at the bottom of the ocean, it pays to do, or it's worth doing, a lot of testing up front. Now, why is that, Brian?
Well, because you want to make sure they do the job. You want to make sure that they can help you predict things. If they're just sitting down there and they're not actually transmitting any data, then what good are they?
True. And it's not like you can just pick it back up and tweak it and then put it back down there. And think of all the costs, the money that's spent just to hoist it back up and hoist it back down. So all that hauling up and down is going to cost a lot of money. So, yes, we want to make sure that everything is accurate. Now, we have here a gentleman, Eiichiro Araki, and he's got a team of researchers with him. From what organization? Where are they, or I should say, who are they representing here?
Okay, they represent Japan's Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology.
All right, and they're setting up shop, or they've set up shop, actually. It's already happened last year, in an equipment plant on the outskirts of Tokyo. Now, normally when we say set up shop, I'm thinking more like you're trying to do business somewhere. You're trying to get some kind of a sale going. But this is not the case, is it, Brian?
No, it's not. Instead, we could almost say they're setting up like a workstation or a work area. So that's where they're going to do their research.
That's right. So, listeners, if you're going to maybe spend a significant amount of time working from a particular place, but it's not going to be permanent, then you can say, I'm setting up shop, you know, at wherever. So let's say you have a big paper you need to write, and you're going to spend a long time, and you decide to work, say, from a coffee shop or some kind of a little restaurant. You can say, I'm setting up shop. And people will understand it's going to be a significant amount of time, but it's not like you're going to live there. So, all right, moving on. Araki says something. What does he say?
He says we need to make sure everything is working. So they've put their equipment into equipment plant in the outskirts of Tokyo, and they need to make sure the equipment that they have is actually workable.
All right. And we get some more description what this equipment is going to be expected to do and how it's going to be used. Tell us, Brian.
Yeah, we learned that these things, these instruments and sensors are going to be cemented into this incredibly deep, half-mile deep borehole under 6,500 feet of water. That's a long way down. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what, taller than a couple skyscrapers or something?
True.
And they're cemented in there because you want them to stay in place. You don't want them to float up or be, you know, blow around or something.
So. Right, but then they want to make sure there are no glitches. And what's a glitch?
Okay, a glitch is also in our vocabulary focus. It's a problem or a fault. So they don't want any problems to get in the way of them making this borehole because they're having to work through water and they're working on the sea floor.
Right. So it would be too late. There are some things, you know, there's always a second chance. But then there are some things you get one chance and that's it. Mm. And so in Mr. Araki's statement here, we can tell that this is one of those one chance kind of a situation. And what is Araki's goal, line 15, Brian?
His goal is to spy on the infamous Nankai Trough. That's quite an interesting way to say it, isn't it?
Yes.
I like that, spy on. So this whole article almost feels like a kind of a spy novel or something.
Okay. Well, infamous. Spying. It does sound like one of those espionage movies. Now, infamous, first of all.
Another word would be like notorious, known for something that is not good rather than known for something that is positive.
Mm.
I think it's interesting he puts that against the Nankai Trough because mm-hmm. usually we think of people being infamous, but he's,
right.
The author has attached it to this natural piece of our earth.
Yes. And make it sound like it's the bad guy.
Yeah.
So just being poetic, having some fun here with the words. Now, trough, I would like to let's talk a little bit about it. Trough, normally for myself, I would think of that feeding, what would you call it, that box, feeding mm-hmm. box that you might see in farms or in zoos where animals get their feed placed in. So you get the animal meal placed in a trough, and then they come over and eat from this big old box. That's what I think of. You know, it's usually not just a square box. It's usually long and deep, or skinny and deep. That's what I think of trough. But then here we see trough is used to describe a different thing. Obviously, we're not feeding animals, right, Brian?
That's right. So, like you said, long and deep. So this is a deep, almost like a skinny valley or something.
Mm, that, nicely said,
that's
yes. That
really digs down deep into the ground.
Right. It is underwater and is similar to something else. What is it? It's compared to?
Right. It's similar to one that they have off the coast of the U.S. Pacific Northwest.
Okay. And both of these, what are they famous for or known for?
Well, they're infamous because they have such destructive potential. They're capable of releasing earthquakes and tsunamis that are similar with the famous Japan tsunami and earthquake.
Okay, so these two are similar. They can both create destruction. And we have a phrase here, on a par with. Mm. On a par with. What is that?
Yeah, just like Brian mentioned, it's similar to mean to be similar with something else.
Okay. A very fancy way of saying similar.
Yeah.
You don't want to use it when you're just chatting with friends. Like, this apple is on par with that apple. No, that sounds a little too much. So, but when you're talking about something more scientific, you're dealing with a paper or maybe a formal speech, on par with would be a rather impressive phrase to use.
Mm.
All right. Now, both faults are, so far from shore, that land-based instruments provide only a fuzzy view. That's a problem. So it's not like people don't have their instruments set up to understand what's going on with these faults. It's just that the instruments so far, what we have so far, are not able to give us the kind of information, clear information or accurate information the way we like it.
And just for our listeners, a fault, we refer to it as a fault line, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is an area where the seafloor has like two plates, two parts of the land
mm-hmm.
Down there in the water
mm-hmm.
That are rubbing up against each other.
Mm-hmm.
We call that a fault line, not a mistake.
Right,
that's the
right.
other meaning of
that's
the word.
That's not my fault. That's your fault. So it's kind of like if you imagine you have two big books side by side and they're rubbing against each other up and down or back and forth. It's kind of like that. And that's what we mean by fault, where we have that space between the two books.
Mm.
Okay, so we want more accurate information, better than what we've been getting so far. At least that's what the scientists are trying to get. All right, well, we still have part two. We're going to find a little bit more of what the scientists are up to in the zone.
In the zone, Japan sits in the crosshairs of four of these so-called subduction zones. So it's no wonder the island nation leads the world in seafloor monitoring. Araki sensors will be some of the most sophisticated ever deployed. The aim is to improve understanding of how subduction zones work, provide rapid tsunami warnings, and, perhaps, answer an intriguing question raised by the 2011 Tohoku quake. Do the world's most dangerous faults signal their intentions by slipping slowly before they snap? Even before the Tohoku quake and tsunami, Japan was gathering data from dozens of ocean bottom sensors. Since then, the country has committed more than $500 million to expanding those networks. Within a few years, Japan will have more than 200 clusters of seismometers and pressure sensors standing sentinel off its shores.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Liz, and we are going over our science article for the month of February. And with me in the studio are Amanda and Brian. And we've been talking about what some Japanese scientists are doing to understand or better understand what's going on in the ocean floor off the coast of Japan so that they can better predict earthquakes. Now, we have a little description here at the beginning of the paragraph, starting on line 25. And again, we're on page 40 of your February issue of Advance Magazine. Japan sits in the crosshairs of four of these so-called subduction zones. Okay, let's just stop right there. That's plenty of information. Help us out, Amanda.
Okay. First of all, the phrase in the crosshairs. In the crosshairs is an idiom, mm-hmm. and it means you're in a position to be attacked. So, where you are, you are open to the enemy.
Okay.
And the enemy could attack you.
Very vulnerable, in other words.
Yes.
You're not very protected, all right? You're not very sheltered. And then we have something here, subduction zones, Brian.
Yeah, these are the zones where those plates, like Amanda referred to earlier with the fault lines, it's where these plates actually rub up against each other and move a lot. So that's where the center or the source of the earthquakes can come from.
Okay. So because Japan is in such a, dare I use the word scary, such a sensitive location, and they're always getting all these earthquakes. That's why this island nation leads the world in seafloor monitoring. Now, to lead the world, that means you are one of the, I guess, if you're not in first place, you're definitely top five. You're one of the leaders in a certain job or a certain area. And in this case, we're talking about seafloor monitoring. And Iraqi's sensors will be some of the most sophisticated ever deployed. Now, again, Iraqi, we talked about earlier in today's lesson, he's a scientist here who's trying to check and make sure that these certain instruments are going to really do a better job than what they have so far already in the bottom of the ocean. And if everything's fine, then he's going to have one of the best ever equipment that can really give us the information we need to better predict earthquakes. Now, I'd like to touch on the word deploy. Brian, what is deploy?
Deploy is to be sent out into use.
Mm-hmm.
My first thought is armies or soldiers being deployed.
Yes.
To the battle line.
Right. So if you follow international news, we hear about certain wars going on or soldiers, peacekeeping troops getting sent around different places where there are conflicts. And the word deploy is usually the official word used to talk about sending soldiers out. But here, in this case, we're also talking about sending out equipment or instruments here. Now, second column, what is the aim? And there were actually three. There are actually three reasons or purposes that the scientists are, you know, they're trying to shoot for here. What's the first one, Amanda?
The first one is to understand how subduction zones work.
Okay. So, again, we want to better understand, since we are sitting in the middle of all this, we want to better understand who they are, what they're all about, I should say. And what's the second one?
To provide rapid tsunami warnings, so even faster.
Okay, yes. If we can find out when the next one's going to hit, well, basically, okay, you have an earthquake, then you have your tsunami, then, you know, if you can figure out, oh, there's one coming, then people will be able to better prepare themselves. Mm-hmm. Then we have the third one. What's the third one?
Well, the third one is to perhaps answer an intriguing question that was raised during or because of the 2011 Tohoku quake.
Okay. The question is, do the world's most dangerous faults signal their intentions by slipping slowly before they snap? Again, the writer is having a little fun with her word choice here. She seems to give human qualities to these different things, be it organizations or natural surroundings. And in this case, to signal your intention, that means to let people know what you plan to do. And obviously, it's not like these faults are, you know, human beings and they're going to, hey, I'm about to blah, blah, blah. It's not like they're going to do that. But can they give us clues? Can we catch certain things or see certain signs before the earthquake hits? That's what they want to know. And we move to the final paragraph here. Even before the Tohoku quake and tsunami, Japan was gathering what, Brian?
They were already gathering data from dozens of ocean bottom sensors, so they were monitoring things already at that point.
Okay, so we need to remember, it's not like they were totally clueless. Okay, they already have equipment. They already have people researching and studying and keeping a close watch. However, because of the earthquake, since then, what has happened? Amanda?
The country has committed more than $500 million to expanding these networks.
Okay, so clearly more needs to be done, and the country feels that it's worth putting in $500 million. That's U.S. dollars here, to expanding. And basically, they want to make the networks be able to cover more and give us more information. And then within a few years, Brian?
They will have more than 200 clusters of seismometers and pressure sensors standing sentinel off of their shores.
Okay. First of all, clusters. What's a cluster?
Cluster is a group.
Okay. It's not, in my mind, when I think of a cluster of something, it's not a very organized group. It's a bunch. Hmm. Okay. We are not talking about something laid out neatly, like in a grid, like 4x3 or 4x4, like in a perfect net. We're thinking about it's probably a little messy, maybe, but they're all connected some way or somehow. Hmm. Maybe, can we say cluster like grapes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So sure. If you can imagine, okay, you have some grapes off the vine. They're all connected, but it's not perfectly organized. Mm-hmm. They're just stuck together. So in the same way, we have these seismometers, and they're a bunch together, and these pressure sensors, and then standing sentinel. Ryan, what's that?
Wow, that's like they're standing guard or standing watch, like security guards. So they're there to give us the warning as soon as possible.
Okay. Again, a very playful way of describing certain research going on in Japan. I'm a little impressed with the way the writer is choosing her words, using these spy terms or military or army ways of talking about a research. Otherwise, that some people might find, you know, maybe, I don't know, for some people, science may not be your cup of tea. But then to describe it this way makes it rather playful. All right. Well, like I mentioned before, this is a 3-day article, and we still have so much more to cover. And I don't know how you feel about earthquakes. If you want to know more, definitely I'd like to encourage you to join us again. Amanda and Brian and I will continue on for the next 2 days. And before we end, let's recap real fast today's lesson. Brian?
Okay. Well, one thing to take away is that Japan was already monitoring the ocean floor, but they really speeded things up, or they beefed it up, I guess I could say, as an idiom. They beefed up their defenses here with Mr. Araki and his team.
Okay. And Amanda?
And before they wanted to put those things in place, they went to the outskirts of Tokyo to make sure the equipment was working, because they only get one chance to put that down there on the seafloor, and they didn't want to make a mistake. They didn't want any glitches.
That's right. Good word. All right. So this is just the beginning. I don't know if we have any questions in mind. Some people might wonder, is it safe? How are we going to get more information? How are the scientists going to find out more? What are they looking for specifically? And what kinds of new equipment are we using to find out more about earthquakes? And how much more can we save because we have this kind of information? So these are questions that I'd like to encourage you to just keep in mind as we continue on with our science article, Shaking Things Up. Until then, I hope you'll join us again tomorrow. My name is Liz.
Brian.
And Amanda.
Saying goodbye.
Goodbye.